From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Washington hawks, military insiders, and congressional leaders are buzzing over whether the time, finally, is right, once and for all, to topple the regime of Iraq's Saddam Hussein. Tonight, On Point, we imagine a Saddam-free Iraqi future and examine the perils that may lie on the other side of regime change. First, we begin tonight with the latest developments on war threats flying between two nuclear powers, India and Pakistan, one day after Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf said he did not want war but would respond to any attack with full force. Pakistan Today conducted a third missile test. Susanna Price is a reporter with the BBC in Pakistan. Earlier, I asked her about India's response to President Musharraf's speech.
They have come out strongly against this speech. They've said they are disappointed that President Musharraf is making the wrong kind of signal here. It was basically all very much to be expected. President Musharraf, in his speech, not only said nothing about any new plans to combat Islamic extremists, which had been demanded by Delhi, but he went further than that. And he actually criticized India quite a lot. He referred to the Hindu chauvinists. He spoke about the killings of Muslims in India. So it was a speech that wasn't really aimed at the Indian public and or at the Indian government, for that matter. And I think it was only really to be expected that the Indian Foreign Minister Jaswant Singh would come out very much against it.
What are the pressures that President Musharraf is trying to negotiate with this speech and with his posture overall right now?
Well, the pressure is on him to try and curb these Islamic militants. These are fighters from Pakistan, also from Kashmir and from elsewhere, who have been trained and funded in Pakistan and who have crossed over the dividing line of control onto the Indian side. Now, it's long been a complaint of India, and now the international community have really decided that that is enough and it has to stop. The reason President Musharraf can't immediately announce that he's going to stop backing these militants, that they're going to stop them crossing over, is that for a long time, Pakistan's whole policy has really been centered around supporting the Kashmiri fighters, supporting what they call the freedom struggle, and calling for the importance of the Indians to get out of Kashmir and the Kashmiris to be allowed to make their own choice. He simply can't abandon that policy. He could abandon the Taliban in Afghanistan. That was different. But Kashmir really goes to the heart of many Pakistanis. So on the one hand, he had to make it very clear to his domestic audience at home that he was not abandoning that policy. On the other hand, he did have to look to the international community, who are putting a lot of pressure on him. We've just had the British Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, here. Christina Rocker was here. We're expecting Richard Armitage to come here soon. There's a lot of pressure here. He's got to tell them he is doing something. What he did was he reiterated that Pakistan would not allow it to be used to export terrorism. But, of course, he's really squeezed here between demands at home and demands abroad.
And today, Pakistan tested a third ballistic missile. What can you tell us about that? Could this be a nuclear delivery device?
This is a short-range surface-to-surface missile. It only has a range of about 180 kilometers, which would really mean it was looking at striking India's borders rather than deep inside India. We've heard suggestions that these short-range missiles would actually be used more for wiping out, for example, military convoys that might be trying to invade. The ones that are more dangerous in terms of nuclear capability are really the medium-range and long-range missiles. And one medium-range missile was tested over the weekend. There were three tests in all, two short-range and one medium-range. Now, Pakistan said this was simply to test the technology. Two of these were newly developed, so they had to try them out. And it said that India tried its missiles out in January. But obviously, the timing is very crucial, and most people will see this as a provocative act in some ways, that at the same time as talking for peace and dialogue, Pakistan is testing weapons that are thought, at least some of them, to be nuclear capable. But I think it was also very much aimed, again, at the domestic audience. General Musharraf was saying, yes, I'm suing for peace. Yes, I want a dialogue. Yes, India has a larger army that's better equipped than we do. But we're not simply going to roll over and let them attack our country. And if they try and attack Pakistan, then we will respond. And he wanted to make it very clear, I think, that Pakistan has adequate deterrence and is prepared to use them.
How does it feel on the ground in Islamabad? Does it have the feeling of a city, of a country on a war footing, with war fever?
Well, people are very worried here. I wouldn't call it war fever. Most people you talk to don't want to go to war. It's not really in Pakistan's interest to go to war. Most people can't see how Pakistan could possibly win a war against India. And, of course, only a couple of years ago, there was a rather ill-advised militants backed by Pakistan made an incursion into Kargil and were beaten back, and Pakistan was widely criticized for that. So people don't want to get involved in a war. And the kind of things they're saying are very interesting. They are blaming both India and Pakistan. They're saying things like they should both stop being so childish. They should grow up. One woman said to me, we're both poor nations. We can't afford a war. Of course, most people here in Pakistan blame India. I think that's only natural given the current climate, the media here and everything else. They believe India started this. They've escalated it. And a lot of people are aware of the dangers of nuclear weapons. We don't have much of a peace lobby here. You don't see large marches out on the streets demonstrating against nuclear weapons. But I think there is an awareness that they can't win using nuclear weapons, and that hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, could be killed.
Any word come out about British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw's meetings with General Musharraf? Has a way out of this standoff been described by him or any of the other third parties trying to play a constructive role?
Well, all of them have been fairly coy about actually revealing the substance of any talks. They've all talked about them as being constructive and useful. Jack Straw had a press conference in which we pressed him very hard on this issue. He would say that they had a good dialogue. He said that President Musharraf was very aware of the international concerns about the Islamic extremists. He also said they discussed the need for dialogue and for talks. But when he was asked if he had a message that he was taking to Delhi, he said he wasn't a messenger and that basically he was here to listen to what President Musharraf had to say, to listen what Mr. Vajpayee had to say, and see if he could do anything to improve the situation.
Susanna Price, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Susanna Price is a reporter for the BBC. She spoke to us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Since seizing power in a bloody coup more than 20 years ago, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has crushed opposition, silenced dissent, and stacked Iraq's government with members of his own family to ensure his grip on power. Meanwhile, the Iraqi people have fallen from one-time prosperity and high hopes to abject poverty and anger at their fate. The people of Iraq are a fractured group. The non-Arab Kurds of the northern mountains struggle against the majority Arab population, while the Arabs themselves are divided between the politically powerful Sunni minority of the middle of the country and the majority Shia of the southern marshlands. The only thing holding the nation together, says our guest tonight, is a common bond of oppression by their ruthless dictator, Saddam Hussein. The international community has been quietly wary of overthrowing Hussein for fear of what would rise in a post-Saddam Iraq. The possible scenarios are grim: civil war among ethnic groups, another remorseless dictator, perhaps Hussein's own son, drastic disruption of vital world oil supplies. As bad as Saddam is, our guest tonight asks if a post-Saddam Iraq could be even worse. You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from Atlanta, Georgia, is Sandra Mackey. She's author of the new book, The Reckoning, Iraq and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. She's written a number of books on the region and has written for many major American newspapers. Good evening and welcome, Sandra Mackey. Great to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
And from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, our own On Point News analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Good evening and hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Sandra Mackey, you are raising all kinds of warning bells about what things might look like on the other side of regime change in Iraq. What's got you so worried about that?
Well, I think we have to look at Iraq as having two big problems for the United States. The first certainly is Saddam Hussein, and we know all the arguments about why he's such a danger to the region. But the other thing that we haven't talked about enough is, what is the nature of Iraq? What is there about this country that poses a whole another set of problems for the United States? doesn't necessarily mean that a post-Saddam Hussein, a post-Saddam Iraq will be worse than the Iraq of Saddam Hussein. It just means that it presents its own sets of problems, which can be just as difficult for the United States to deal with.
But as I read your book, Sandra Mackey, it looks like a pretty menacing potential post-Saddam Iraq that is falling into sharply divided, warring fragments, the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shiite, which, first of all, could tear Iraq apart with everything that means about creating vacuums in the area, and secondly, could create an enormous vacuum, not to say chaos, around oil fields that the whole world relies on.
Well, that is certainly the problem. And Iraq is a contrived country that, as most of your listeners know, was put together in 1921 to meet the imperial needs of Britain at the end of the First World War. And, you know, it is not the only contrived country in the world, and it doesn't have necessarily a unique set of problems with communalism. What makes it so difficult for the United States is that Saddam Hussein has spent 20 years just ripping civil society apart in Iraq, and you have now layered that on top of these very old rivalries that really went back even into the days of the Ottoman Empire, but certainly have been there since the founding of the state. And the question becomes, if you take this dictator out very rapidly, what's going to happen? Are the Iraqis going to really take their revenge on each other for what has really been a terrible period for everyone? Are the Shia going to react against the Sunnis because they have been really an oppressed majority since the beginning of the state? Are the Kurdish tribes going to fight each other as well as fighting the Arabs of Iraq? And these are the questions we have to really think about before we start racing down the war, down the road to an invasion of Iraq.
Senator Mackey, we've had on this show Richard Pearl describing to us what he anticipates, which is Iraqis dancing in the streets along the lines of what we saw in Kabul not so many months ago, delighted to be liberated from Saddam Hussein by American forces.
Well, I think maybe when the Americans come on the horizon, that would be the reaction of perhaps some people. But I don't think Mr. Pearl has spent time in Iraq like I have, really sensing how much the people hold the United States, rightly or wrongly, responsible for the sanctions that have been on them for the last 10-plus years. And we have to realize that this is a regime that totally controls the media. It's also a country in which the United States perhaps could have put more effort into getting some sort of communications into the country in which you would have defined a vision for Iraq. But what has happened is that the Iraqis really have come to see the United States only in terms of war or sanctions, and they do not see the United States in terms of a better future.
Not necessarily as a savior. Jack Beatty, this country has kept American administrations on their toes and itching the trigger without pulling it for a long time now.
It has, and you can, although they haven't found a direct connection with 9/11 from Iraq, there is this obvious connection. That is, it was our deployment of forces in Saudi Arabia to contain Iraq. That was one of the stated reasons of Al Qaeda's, of Bin Laden's attack on us. So yes, it has really cost us this long antagonism, and it could cost us more, and that's why the U.S. military, and what I think is a major departure, predicted on this program by John Mearsheimer, I should say, is telling the civilian leadership in the Pentagon, let's go slow on this. This is very risky.
And yet Saddam Hussein's is nobody's idea of a great guy. How do we deal with Saddam Hussein without creating more danger than we solve? Could a post-Saddam Iraq be even more threatening to itself and the world? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about regime change and reality in Iraq tonight. Our guest is Sandra Mackey. She's out with a new book, The Reckoning, Iraq and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. Could a post-Saddam Iraq be even more threatening to itself and the world? And is the U.S. military now afraid of another Vietnam in Iraq? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sandra Mackey, you described the U.S. military and other military organizations as having been afraid after the Gulf War that if they went after Saddam, they would undermine the internal stability of the entire country. Do you see that as a key factor in what kept the U.S. military from going to Baghdad 10 years ago?
Well, there were two reasons why we didn't go. The first was that the coalition that George Bush put together to fight the Gulf War, which by necessity had to include some of the Arab states in order to give us some cover in the Arab world, really required a pledge on the part of the United States that we would not invade Iraq. So that was a very important aspect of it. Secondly, I think not only the military leaders, but certainly the civilian leaders were very afraid of what we have just been talking about, is that you go into Iraq and you get caught in this quicksand of, trying to put the country back together after the end of Saddam Hussein. And so those, that was a very big consideration in not marching on Baghdad in 1991.
We have callers who want to get in here. Let's welcome them. Saeed is calling from Albany, New York. Good evening and welcome, Saeed.
Good evening. I just have a small comment, and I let other callers get in. I do disagree with your writer that is calm. I think she has never been in Middle East. She has no concept of our culture.
Just to be factual, Sandra Mackey has spent a lot of time in the Middle East. But your point.
No, I doubt it because she has never been in the population.
On that simple point, it's a fact. So we can settle that.
Whatever is the fact is you have to go to the population. You can't just go from a couple of the people that you know or you talk and then get the idea from the community.
What's your point of disagreement, Saeed?
Let me get to my point, and then I will get off the phone, and then your guest can answer the question. My point is that the only reason that United States did not invade Iraq was the oil money. And as long as there is an oil, there's not going to be any Yugoslavia after Saddam, because Saddam is not Marshal Tito. Marshal Tito was different. He helped the Yugoslavia by putting different ethnic groups against each other.
Mm-hmm.
In Iraq, it's not like that. Those people, they know one goal. Every leader or any insurgency coming up in the Middle East, you can see my country, an example in Iran, as long as there is an oil money, the groups come together. Right now, the Kurds. The Kurds are making the most money from illegal disposal of Saddam's oil through their borders to Turkey.
So, Saeed, I just want to be sure I have your point. You're saying if Saddam goes and the opportunity for the country, for Iraq, to share in oil wealth returns, Iraqis will unite around that.
There will be another dictator. There will be another dictator in different ways.
But not a civil war. Saeed, thanks for your call. Sandra Mackey, how about it?
Well, I certainly think he has a point. I think in the short term, there, regardless of what happens, there's going to be a lot of chaos in Iraq. The question is, how soon can the Iraqis get together, or if they can get together? And there is this sense of Iraqi nationalism that, they've had 80 years of statehood. They have a sense that they really are an important country. They have the potential to be a rich country. And, the question is that strong enough to really play to the nationalistic side of the Iraqis versus the divisions on ethnicity and sect.
Mm-hmm. Sandra Mackey, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome in Fawaz Jerges. He's professor of international affairs and Middle Eastern studies at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. Good evening and welcome, Fawaz Jerges.
It's my pleasure.
It's good to have you with us. You've heard the comments there in our caller who just called in and said, look, don't worry, Iraq is no Yugoslavia, Saddam is no Marshal Tito. After a regime change, it won't all fall apart. The oil wealth, or the prospect of it, will hold the country together. Do you feel that we can be confident of that?
Well, I think one has to keep in mind when we talk about possibilities and scenarios that the manner in which regime change is affected will have a great deal of impact on the future dynamics of Iraqi politics.
So the way in which it happens.
Absolutely. And here I think I want to add with Sandra to second what she said, a while ago. I think we need to realize that the likelihood of failure is much higher than the prospect of success.
That is the failure of what in particular?
The failure that after Saddam Hussein leaves the scene, that somehow putting Iraq together, reconstructing Iraqi civil society, rebuilding the institutions, gluing Iraq together after Saddam Hussein exits from the scene, I think the likelihood of doing that is much lower.
Why do you think the odds are against that kind of successful outcome?
But I think, and here is my point, the chances, that the chances of failure are quite high, there's a good possibility that Iraqi society will rise to the challenge if the right opportunities present themselves. And let's remember that Iraq is one of the wealthiest states in the Middle East and has great economic potentials and can afford to pay for its own political and economic reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Although Iraqi society is fragmented and splintered, I think a sense of nationalism, as Sandra has said, and pride resonates in the Iraqi collective imagination.
And yet you don't see it as an odds-on winner after a regime change.
The state, as opposed to the ruling Ba'athist regime, the state itself, mm-hmm. as she said, has grown deep roots in society. And let's remember that during the bloody Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, Ayatollah Khomeini's gamble on the Iraqi Shia mm-hmm. to rebel against the Sunni-dominated state and join their religious cohorts in Iran did not materialize, mm-hmm. that the Iraqi Shiites behaved more as Iraqi nationalists rather than Islamists. And here, mm-hmm. I think the point to highlight, if the international community, particularly the United States, invest in rebuilding Iraqi society and institutions after the exit of Saddam Hussein from mm-hmm. the scene and maintains a long-term commitment to reconstructing state and society, I think Iraq might have a good chance of functioning as a viable state. But the point to keep in mind is that the manner in which regime change is affected will have a great deal of impact on how the situation evolves.
We'll talk about that, but I want to put this one point to Sandra Mackey. Sandra, you describe Iraqis as being so deeply disillusioned, not to say outraged with the U.S., that they, as you describe them, don't sound like they'd be very welcoming of American nation building.
I would really agree with what Dr. Fowler said about, you know, how you go about the regime change is going to make all the difference in the world. And if you have a unilateral American invasion of Iraq, that is the worst case scenario, because that just inflames all sorts of passions across the Arab world.
Well, the U.S. military brass seem to be seconding that notion right now and duking it out with some of the more hawkish elements in the Bush administration. If an invasion is not the way, what in your mind, Sandra Mackey, would be a path to regime change that raises the best possibility for a good outcome on the other side?
Well, you know, in a perfect world, you would have a group of perhaps army officers stage a coup. We've been waiting a long time for that. That hasn't happened, and I don't know that it will happen. But I think on the other hand, you have to look at Iraq as being such an oppressive, terrible regime that it is sagging from its own weight, that you can have a horrible police state, you can have people terrified all the time, and that's certainly effective, and it's effective in Iraq today. But how long can you keep that up without totally alienating, large parts of the population?
Well, even though they may be alienated, they have not pulled off a coup. Fawaz Jirjej, what's your prescription for an effective form of regime change that would make possible a healthy Iraq on the other side?
One point must be stressed, I think, at the onset, that the problematic is toppling Saddam Hussein is much easier than trying to deal with the subsequent unpredictable aftershocks. There are no easy solutions here. Iraq is a highly volatile and complex society. Iraq has been ruled by one of the bloodiest dictatorships in the Third World. Iraqi civil society has been politically and militarily suppressed. Saddam Hussein plunged Iraq into several devastating regional wars that bled Iraqi civil society dry. For the last 11 years, Iraq has been burdened by one of the most stringent sanctions regimes in history. The middle and professional class has been decimated. Today, Iraq, which used to be, as I said, one of the wealthiest countries in the Middle East, is a skeleton and a shadow of its former self. And of course, for the last 11 years, we have gambled. We have gambled on the fact that the painful sanctions will force the Iraqi people to rebel and overthrow their ruling tyrant. But of course, the sanctions, far from undermining Saddam Hussein, have weakened Iraqi civil society mm-hmm. further and have consolidated the Iraqi regime hold on the country. I think the critical questions are, to my mind, the following. Does the U.S. foreign policy establishment appreciate the complexity of Iraqi political culture? Does the Bush administration realize that the opposition is deeply fragmented and splintered along ethnic and regional lines? Do we really appreciate the fact that the opposition is no more than a mirror image of the existing political structure? Does the Bush administration have the political will and nerve to engage in nation building in Iraq? To what extent will the United States have the staying power and the nerves to remain engaged in Iraq and try to heal the deep wounds of civil society and rebuild its shattered institutions? What if Iraq descends into chaos and civil war, which is a high possibility? Will the United States pack and leave, or will it invest political and military capital in restoring order and civility to the country? What I'm trying to suggest, all options are difficult and complex. And before somehow plunging into a military adventure in Iraq, the United States must be aware of the complexity of the situation and the risks inherent in such an adventure.
Jack Beatty, it sounds as though, from what we hear out of Washington, that this administration is growing more attuned to those complexities, not less.
Yes, and it's hearing about them from the military, who are talking about the likelihood that in a use them or lose them situation, that the Hussein would use chemical weapons, biological weapons against U.S. forces. And they're telling him that having to take Baghdad in some sort of city fighting would also cause lots of U.S. casualties, lots of Iraqi casualties. And they're telling him that the consequences on the other side that we've just heard so much about are so imponderable, it's not as if you're delivering a sure thing. On the other hand, I am looking at a report from the Monterey Institute of the nuclear, biological, chemical, and missile capabilities of Iraq, and it occupies two full pages with details that, I mean, the bottom line is that within a couple of years, they can produce a weapons-grade nuclear material, and they have delivery systems, and they already have anthrax delivery systems. The question is there a clock running that forget about what's going to happen after Hussein. Mm-hmm. Is there a clock running that says we have to act now for our own interest before terrorists using Iraq as a cutout get this stuff and use it against us? Or is that just a bogeyman of our current fear? I mean, so in other words, the questions about what happens in Iraq are important, of course. But
the clear and present danger is also sitting there.
Yes.
May I inject myself?
Senator Mackey, please.
Yes.
You've written that Saddam is only 30 pounds of enriched uranium shy of a nuclear weapon.
Yes, and I think one of the things we need to keep in mind is that Saddam Hussein does these really crazy things like attacking Iran in 1980 and invading Kuwait in 1990 when he really feels pushed against the wall. And one of the things that we need to think about is this talk about invasion, is this maybe staging more naval forces in the Persian Gulf as early as November 30th going to trigger Saddam Hussein's erratic behavior in order to try to save himself. This is not indulging in psychobabble. It's just something to say, is this another thing we have to consider? And also what we need to do is to really get back with the plan by Sam Nunn, former senator, to get these fissionable materials of the former Soviet Union locked up.
We know Iraq is shopping there. Senator Mackey, stand by. I want to get a call in here. John's on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Very interesting discussion. I want to start with a comment, and that is that all the discussion about Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction and his willingness to use them against anybody who would conquer his nation applies to us, too. And I don't think there should be much doubt about that. And it's awful of him, but I think it's awful of us. And
but, John, we haven't gassed domestic populations. We haven't gone to...
Wait a second. We have used the atomic bomb twice when a lot of historians thought it was unnecessary. We killed millions of people in Vietnam with chemical weapons.
But what's your point, John? Is there a moral relativism here that should make us feel easier at night?
No, I would just say that there's a little arrogance as though there's a group of people talking in the heart of the empire about how they're going to impose their will on their subjects, the barbarian though they may be.
Well, there clearly is that kind of tone, isn't there?
Yes, in your program, on all members. Now, let me make another comment. In terms of what will happen in that area, should the United States go to war? Unless the United States is able to use divide and conquer power politics, setting nations like Iran and Iraq against one another, using Saddam Hussein as it did in one of the bloodiest wars in history for its purposes, unless we can do that, if the United States launches an attack on Iraq, there'll be tremendous resistance in the region. Not a resistance of terrain. It's not a question of mountains, we do deserts. It'll be a question of the people.
So you're talking about people pushing back. Fawaz, please come in here.
I think John is raising a very important point here. We're talking about whether to attack Iraq or not, really, in a vacuum. I think we need to also look at how the situation is perceived from the other angle, that is, from the Arab and Muslim perspective. I think the reverberations of an escalating Iraqi crisis might not only intensify and deepen anti-Americanism throughout the Arab lands, but also endanger the stability of some of the pro-Western Arab regimes, particularly Jordan and Saudi Arabia. And here, if I might add another point, in the Middle East, everything tends to be connected to everything else. It would be highly reckless to initiate a military offensive against Iraq while the fighting continues on the Israeli-Palestinian theater. It's crucial that the United States here that tries to nudge the Israelis and Palestinians back into the negotiating table before plunging into the Iraqi quagmire, if it has to.
So, we just have 30 seconds before the break. Assuming that can be calmed, and that's a big assumption, how would you recommend the U.S. deal with Saddam Hussein?
Well, I think at this particular sense, I think our priorities are being reversed. I would suggest that finding a political solution to the escalating Israeli-Palestinian conflict is much more urgent than somehow trying to deal with Saddam Hussein, because if you do resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, you are redrawing the political map of the Middle East and puncturing, I think, a major nail in the coffin of the Arab authoritarian state, particularly the Iraqi regime.
Fawaz Sirjis, we're out of time for this segment. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Fawaz Sirjis is author of the forthcoming book, The Islamists and the West. We're talking about Iraq now and later. How do we deal with Saddam Hussein without creating more danger than we solve? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about regime change in Iraq. And what might follow regime change in Iraq? What might follow the downfall of Saddam Hussein? How do we deal with Saddam Hussein without creating more peril than we solve, than we push away? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Sandra Mackey. She's out with a big new book called The Reckoning, Iraq and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. She's also author of The Saudis Inside the Desert Kingdom and Lebanon, Death of a Nation. Sandra Mackey, I asked earlier and how we do deal with Saddam. You said sort of wishfully you wish it would happen from within. But as we've seen, we've waited a long time and that hasn't happened. If people decide, as Jack Beatty points out, that there's too much danger, that something has to happen and it's not happening from inside, what is your prescription?
Well, in my book, I say that, you know, there may come a point that the United States has to intervene in Iraq, either the danger of nuclear weapons becomes so great, not only the danger of Saddam Hussein having them, but possibly using them and changing the strategic balance of the region. Or if, you know, Saddam Hussein continues to be in power, but really loses control of much of the country, which could certainly happen.
But if we have to do that, Sandra Mackey, do I hear you ducking me out there? Well, how would you actually suggest we go about it if we have to actively do it?
Well, I think, as Foz says, you know, the first thing we have got to do, and we've got to do as soon as possible, is try to get some sort of agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, even if it requires putting American forces in there to monitor the peace. Once we do that, then we have a lot more leeway in dealing with Saddam Hussein because, frankly, the road to Baghdad does run through Jerusalem. If we can get that accomplished, then we have more ability to go in under some kind of coalition. Again, we can't do it unilaterally, but if we can pull some of the other Arab states, the rest of the international community in, then yes, we could have an invasion, and possibly we could get the Iraqi people to accept that. But that also requires a real commitment on the part of the United States to draw a vision for the Iraqi people about what the future is going to look like, and be willing to stay the course and to see that they are put on the road to a better future, and also, frankly, to keep some control over some of these more extreme elements that might tend to take revenge on each other. It's a huge order, and it's one that certainly the Clinton administration understood. They chose to follow the sanctions policy and weapons control. Some of that was a necessity. I think that we did lose some time in not, trying to identify with the Iraqi people to try to somehow get the word in that we really were on their side and not Saddam Hussein's side.
If you're at all right in your book, that message has not come across. Benjamin is on the line. Welcome, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. My point is that any attempt to invade Iraq would be very, very disastrous.
In what sense, Benjamin?
In terms that Saddam Hussein, we knew what he did during the Desert Storm. He's going to rain all his dangerous weapons on Israel and Kuwait.
He's going to drop his dangerous weapons on Israel and Kuwait.
Exactly. Unless the United States is willing to nuke the whole of Iraq. The United States has put itself in a very dangerous position by pinpointing just an element, Saddam Hussein, as the only enemy.
So, Benjamin, are you saying that means that we cannot or should not go after Saddam?
We should not go after Saddam. And again, let me tell you, a homogeneous society is much easier to reform. But a heterogeneous society like that of Iraq or even Afghanistan. We've not even succeeded in Afghanistan.
Benjamin, thanks for your call. I want to put it to Sandra Mackey. What about the weapons that Saddam might pull out, as you say, if his back's against the wall? Who is at greatest danger of being on the receiving end?
I would guess Israel.
Where does that leave us?
Well, that leaves us with the probability that Israel will strike back with its own nuclear arsenal or its own missiles. And I think that's one of the things that is left off the table all the time. When you start talking about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, no one talks about Israel's weapons of mass destruction. And if you really want to stabilize the Middle East, what you need to do is work toward a nuclear-free zone, which, of course, is a very hard political sell in the United States.
Jack, we're trying to push toward greater clarity on this subject tonight, but there's just layer after layer here. You point out the mounting real danger of weapons of mass destruction. Sandra Mackey says, well, Iraq's not the only one that has them. And caller John says, the U.S., you've got them too. There's moral relativism. There's danger on the other side of any kind of intervention. And yet there's danger now as well.
Yeah, danger everywhere. I mean, in terms of the moral relativism, we have these weapons. We haven't used them against our own people. Yes, we did use the atomic bombs, but you know, I think, and that was that's still debated. It ended World War II, which was a horror itself. So one horror to end another horror. But you know, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, there have been hints that they're thinking of other things, that they're thinking of covert operations, that they're thinking of bribes. What we know about Saddam is that he lives in a kind of Xanadu of auto-suggestion. People tell him only what he wants to hear, only, you know, he's got these incredible paranoiac devices and systems around him. This is a person who's not in touch. And it strikes me that that is the kind of dictator, as opposed to someone who's, you know, wired into everything, that could be destabilized. And, you know, bribes, covert actions, sabotage, who knows? There are lots of things we could do short of having the onus of an out-and-out war on Iraq, which I think, under the circumstances, would be a very risky undertaking indeed. And, you know, in terms of the connection to terrorism, here's the State Department. The State Department report, no anti-Western terrorist operations from Iraq since 1993 when they set about trying to kill former President Bush.
Well, that's a long time. Sandra Mackey reminds us that even on the other side, there's a lot to keep an eye on in this big and fractious country. Sandra Mackey, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Sandra Mackey is author of The Reckoning, Iraq and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. You can continue this conversation online at our website, onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, square dancing to techno music. Jack, thanks for being with us. This is On Point. Occasionally on this program, we turn to music experts and to listeners to tell us what music has been moving them. Artists from Beethoven to the Byrds have created pastoral music that evokes country landscapes and simpler times. Gerald Marzorati is editorial director of the New York Times Magazine. Lately, he's been intrigued by popular music's tendency to turn to nostalgic sounds and has been drawn to the electronic pastoral music in which he finds a soundtrack for our modern condition.
In popular music, as in classical music, there is expressed a yearning for the countryside, whether it's Bob Dylan's basement tapes that he made with the band or, you know, Beethoven's Symphony No. 6. This desire to have music represent or conjure the countryside is not a rural urge, it's an urban urge. It's a sophisticated city person's notion of absence or longing that creates this desire to create this kind of music. When music becomes, or seems to be becoming, too urban, too complicated, too decadent, too cosmopolitan, there seems to be a kind of musical reaction which performs a kind of corrective, a sort of hinterland restorative for music. That function you've seen surface in the last 18 months or so with the popularity of the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack. People associate traditional forms of folk music or country music with something simple, something that takes them out of their sort of urban existence. The world seems fearful, complicated. The yearning for the pastoral is a yearning for some simpler time, some more innocent time. Some place that seems safe and soothing.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way if we'll keep on the sunny side of life.
What I think is most interesting about pastoral music right now is coming out of, paradoxically, the most cosmopolitan and urban of music undergrounds, the dance music or electronic music underground. what I like about this music is that it shows that pastoral music need not always be nostalgic or rustic, that you can conjure the countryside in ways that are adventurous and experimental. The key thing that makes electronic pastoral music different from the pastoral music that most people associate with popular music is that it's not songs per se. There aren't typical verse melody constructions. There may not even be lyrics at all. They are essentially soundscapes in which musical textures and musical colorations, which are created electronically, evoke certain feelings that we associate with the countryside, certain moods, certain climates. These sounds can summon the outdoors literally or metaphorically, or they can conjure innocence in the sense of there being childlike melodies or childlike sounds, or they can just have the rhythm and feel of seeing the landscape from a train, as you know. I mean, listening to a lot of this electronic music, I think, is like being on a high-speed train going through the French countryside. You see glimpses of color and shifts in landscape and shifts in mood, and that's what this music does. The most important or influential of these electronic pastoral artists is a duo from Scotland called the Boards of Canada. A lot of this electronic pastoral music is little more than new age elevator music, but this music is a sort of a conjuring of the mood of the countryside. It's mellow, it's soft, it's inviting. You hear these very gentle electro beats. You get hints of children's laughter. You get slow rhythmic repetition, which to me conjures a drive through the countryside. It sort of collapses the distance between city and countryside, which is our kind of modern condition, which is to say there's a way in which you kind of sense that this music is being made electronically on a laptop, and yet the mood of the music is not at all urban. And for me, that there's no other music that is able to kind of collapse that distance, to conjure that closeness of countryside and city that is our condition. One of the things that's most interesting that's going on in this music now is the melding and blending of what we think of as traditional country instruments, such as the folk guitar, with electronic instruments. The Boards of Canada do that. You can hear that on an album that's one of my favorites by an artist who calls himself Fortet, a Canadian artist, his album called Pause. I mean, you get this guitar playing that older listeners might associate with the English folk music of the 60s by people like Pentangle and Fairport Convention, mixed with dance music beats and colorations.
Gerald Marzorati is editorial director of the New York Times Magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by